Hey, I'm Robbie Kramer. You're listening to the Leverage Podcast, where we discuss using your social skills to hack dating, travel, finding your dream job, and becoming a complete man.
What's up, guys? This is the Leverage Podcast. I've got a good buddy of mine, Drew Gatsby. I'm going to call him Drew Gatsby because that's his nickname. So I'm going to ask you where you got that nickname in a second. Drew is just, he's a beast with chicks. Every since the day I met him, he's constantly had either a model girlfriend or models hanging all over him. He manages a sports bar in Tribeca, Warren 77, and he's really taken that place up a level. And before that, he was one of the biggest club promoters in New York. So super stoked to have you on, Drew. Thanks for joining the call.
Of course. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Yeah. And also the newest Leverage moderator. Forgot to add that.
Yes.
How did you get the Gatsby nickname?
The Gatsby nickname came from when I first moved to New York. I got hired as a promoter almost 3 days after I moved here. So I wasn't really sure like how the New York City nightlife scene was, what it was all about, what I was getting myself into. So to kind of protect myself, I changed my Facebook name from my full real name to just Drew Michael, which is my middle name. So then, you know, back then, Instagram wasn't really the biggest thing. It was just kind of starting to take off. It was like the newest social media platform. So people weren't really kind of like connecting through Instagram. It was more of just, at that time, Instagram was still an idea. It was still something that people were fooling with and what it was capable of. So I kind of just had this Facebook, and that's how I connected with a lot of people that I did my networking for, like socially, you know, online, dealing with getting girls like friend requests and stuff like that. It all went through Facebook. So it kind of was a way to protect myself. I changed my name to just my first and my middle name. Fast forward maybe 3 or 4 years, where now I'm at the top of my game. I've got, you know, girls with me every night. Usually some kind of pro athlete or any kind of A-list, B-list, C-list celeb at any point. And one of my buddies came up to me and he said, you know, I've known you for 4 years and I don't actually know your last name. And it's funny that you bring this up because my buddy that I just talked to last night, he's a GM over at Avenue. He also, again, asked me last night before we went to the Yankees game, he said, what's your last name? So it was actually this huge secret from people that my last name, it was just something that no one ever knew. Yeah, my buddy came up to me and was just like, listen, he's like, I've known you for 3 or 4 years. You have huge parties. You have all these girls. You have all these like different kinds of celebs and athletes around you, but no one knows anything about you. No one knows where you're from. No one knows what you do before this. No one knows your real name. And then he goes, holy shit, you're like the great Gatsby. And it just kind of caught fire. People just started calling me Gatsby. And then he started it, my buddy Rob. And then my group initially started calling me Gatsby. And then I changed my Instagram name. And then it said Drew Gatsby. And then everybody started calling me Gatsby because they all realized they didn't know my last name. So to this day, actually, my buddy, like I said last night, Jared, asked me what my last name was. I've known him for about 4 or 5 years. He's the GM at Avenue, like I said. And he asked me last night. He goes, dude, what's your last name? And so it was just funny that even to this day, people are still asking me what my last name is. It's a privilege secret.
I think I know it. I think it rhymes with Schmilton. But
I'm sure there's certain people at this point who do know, because now that I'm out of the nightlife game, you know, I guess I should say nightclub game, now that I'm out of that, it's not really that big a deal if people know it. Obviously, a lot of people here at my new job at Warren all know it because it's on all my papers, it's on my paychecks, it's on everything. So other than that, well, anybody in the nightclub scene.
It's going to add to the secret with chicks. Anytime someone wants to know, it means they care.
So tell me, you know, before I ask you how you got into promoting and all that stuff, were you, I'm sure some of the guys on the call would like to know kind of like, what were you like before you got into, you know, the nightlife scene? What were you like growing up? Were you ever shy? Did you ever struggle with chicks?
Oh my God. Yes. I'm glad you brought it up because it actually started way before I even joined nightclubs. When I was in high school, I was, and Robbie knows this, I played hockey, I played basketball. When I was 16, I got a national ranking in basketball. It was like a big deal. I was just one of those kids that like my only focus was sports. My only focus was like athletics and that was it. And when it came to girls, I wouldn't say that I was shy, But I was one of those people that just hones in on rejection. So like if I was talking to a girl and, you know, maybe I'm 15, 16 and she just maybe, you know, we're teenagers, but still maybe she denies me or says like, oh, I don't want to hang out or whatever like that is, you know, obviously in high school, it's a little bit more cool, but, I would hone in on that. I would be like, what's wrong with me? What did I do? Like, I'm an athlete. And like, I wasn't, you know, I wasn't ugly by any means, but it was just like, it was a struggle for me. It was a definite confidence struggle because when I was on the court, you know, that's like, that's your sanctuary. That's like where everything is cool and everything's great. When I'm on the ice, everything's great. And as soon as you step off, all that confidence kind of went away. Like, I just didn't really have it. And, it was something that I struggled with for a long time. It was like, if I was in a relationship, I was overbearing because I always thought like, maybe this is the only girlfriend I'll ever get. You know what I mean? Like stuff like that. And I was very much like that. I was very much like I was honed in on my rejections and I focused on my negativities and what I did wrong. And it was just a struggle all the way around. So what changed was when I graduated, because I was an athlete, most of my friends were a little bit older than me because, you know, as a freshman coming onto the varsity basketball team, you know, your captains are all seniors and like, you know, you stay friends with those guys because they help you through the struggles of being a young, you know, player in high school basketball, especially with the pressure that I had at the time, you know, my sophomore year, at the end of my sophomore year is when I got a ranking. So being young and being in that situation, all my friends were older than me. So, you know, when I was 17, my friends were 21 and stuff like that. And, you know, all in college and I've graduated. So the whole thing that I wanted to talk about with that whole, you know, honing in on rejection and being shy and stuff like that was that, it's a mental thing. It's really a mental trap. It's like, it literally for me, I just was at home one day, it was the summertime after I graduated high school. And I was like, I just don't want to be that guy anymore. I literally had to say it to myself. I was like, I just don't want to be that guy anymore. I want to be more outgoing. I want to be more, I can like, you know, brush things off my shoulder, be more confident in the way that I handle myself. And I started slow. I started doing poker nights with my buddies and just like, you know, cause at the time, you know, backstory, my mom and my dad had just gotten divorced when I was 16. So my mom had bought a new house, but a year later now she had a boyfriend who lived about an hour away from us. So she was kind of always there because she had an office in his town as well. So I kind of lived by myself at 17. So for me, it was easy to kind of just throw a poker night with me and my buddies and drink a couple beers and, you know, whatever. And most of us either had girlfriends or, you know, we had talked to a couple girls every now and then. And so they would come over, you know, every now and then. And then it kind of got bigger. More people started showing up. And then I said, well, fuck it. I'll just start throwing parties. You know, I live by myself. The house is brand new. It's a pretty dope house. There's three bedrooms. Like, fuck it. Let's start throwing parties. You guys can all afford to buy kegs and stuff like that. So let's just do it. And so that's what I started doing. I started throwing parties in my own house. And that gives you a whole new level of how people look at you because all of a sudden they're like, oh, well, this is the guy that's throwing parties. Like he's in charge. You know what I mean?
So yeah. Well, I thought this, really, who's this guy?
It really helped build that confidence that I was like, yeah, like this is dope. Like everyone kind of looks to me when there's a problem or everyone kind of looks to me when there's like, where's the alcohol or, you know, whatever. So it really helped build, you know, my confidence level. When I was obviously before that in a very opposite sense, just not confident, not, you know, anything like that. So that was kind of how it all started. Was it's just a mental talk that I had with myself. And I was like, I just don't want to be this person. And you, it, obviously there's still, it's kind of like you have relapses, you know, like you kind of, maybe you meet a girl that you really like, and then it doesn't work out. And then all of course I'm sitting there honing in on what I did wrong or whatever. But after a while, you kind of just, I think the more times that it happens, the more you're kind of accustomed you get to it and the easier it is to brush it off and just say no. And that's why I say now, you know, after doing what I've done and all that stuff is I tell everyone to be a quarterback. Just forget the last pass. Just if you go out there and you throw an interception, just be an NFL quarterback. You go out there for the next series and you totally forget what happened the last time you were out in the field. So that was kind of my limit, was that I had to just mentally tell myself, I just don't want to be this guy anymore.
Well, it's funny that, you know, I've never really heard your story like that, or maybe I did, but who knows, maybe
I was on some substances
that, exactly, I was on some substances that made me forget, but it's so crazy how similar it was to me, because I was the same thing. I honed in on sports, I played hockey and golf, I was nationally ranked in golf, and I also took rejection pretty personally and pretty hard, because I wasn't used to it. And, right, you know, I get on the golf course, I get in the rink, and I would just be like, I'd be the fucking man. But then you know, when it came to girls, I'd just be like, what am I doing? I have no
fucking clue. And I'm sure that, like, you also thought that that would correlate, that being good on the sports field, being that kind of guy would correlate to more women, more attention.
But yeah, that's what you think. It really doesn't. I mean, unless you're like the, you know, I mean, usually they talk about the high school quarterback of the football team, but it's not just that he's a good quarterback. It's he's also a social beast in most situations,
right,
which is why he's a quarterback in the first place.
If you look at
any
captain of the football team, any quarterback of the football team, they've got, you know, most of the times they've got good families. They're built, you know, they're a little bit bigger than everybody
else. Their dad was the captain.
They're a little bit
more
like puberty hit than like 11. You know what I mean? Like,
my buddy was a,
right.
Yeah, my buddy that lived down the street became the quarterback of our high school team, and he would used to like tie me up in his garage and duct tape me and put lighter fluid on the ground and terrorize the other kids.
I got bullied, shit like that. Yeah, yeah. I was small. I was 5'3" until I was in ninth grade. Going into ninth grade, I grew 8 inches.
Same with me, man. But mine was between freshman and sophomore year. And I had the same kind of epiphany as a junior in high school. I was like, you know what? I don't want to be this guy anymore. And, you know, one day I made a call, and everyone's heard my story, so I'm not going to go into it, but I made one call to a girl I know. I said, hey, can I come to the football game with you guys? Sure. And then that blossomed into my social circle. So
it's always the first step of making that phone call or having that talk with yourself. It's always just, it starts with you. It has to be that whole, listen, I'm going to do this. It can't be anybody else's decision. You can't be. It's like trying to force someone to go to rehab. If they don't want to go, they're not going to get better. So for you, it's like you have to be able to say, like, no, I want to go to the football game with these friends, or me, like, I want to be the guy that throws the parties. And it starts with that barrier that you have to break down in your own head.
Yeah. So this was all in high school, all the parties and all that stuff when you were living alone, right?
So then actually I had a huge thing. So when I went to college, I was actually I was dating this girl. So I was also in a band at the time. It was something that I did kind of as a side thing while I was in school. I love being a musician. I love being able to play music. I play guitar and I play piano. And when I was in high school, it was just kind of like a fun thing to do. You know, you play some local shows and, you know, that was kind of like a thing that we didn't start doing until I was 17 after I started graduating. So that also helped a little bit. But I'll get to that in a different time. So basically through the band, I meet this girl named Alyssa. Alyssa goes to a neighboring high school, but I'm going to be a freshman in college. She's going to be a senior in high school. So we start dating. It was just one of those toxic relationships. We were jealous of everybody else around us, and I didn't want guys around her. She didn't want girls around me. And then going to different schools, like, I'm a freshman in college. I want to be able to go out, drink, and party, and whatever. Not like, you know, go and hook up with a bunch of girls at the time or whatever, because I was, you know, dating Alyssa. So I was kind of a good guy at the time. But I had this for, you know, my freshman year, my entire freshman year of college, I was dating Alyssa. And like I said, it was toxic. So it was always going to end. So basically when it did end, going into my sophomore year, all of the girls that I had met, you know, while I was dating Alyssa and had been the good guy and said, no, I'm not going to cheat. That's a shitty thing to do, whatever. I was young, stupid. And so basically every girl that I had spoken to, gotten a phone number for, I just started going down the list and just putting myself out there with all these different girls and trying to go to parties that maybe I wouldn't have gone to before, you know, whatever it was. And, but then, you know, after I'd broken up with Alyssa and whatever that happened, it kind of does take its toll on you, because then all of a sudden you start thinking, well, Alyssa loved me and this girl just told me no. So, you know, holy shit, like, what am I doing wrong? Should I be more like the guy that I was when I was with her? Even though you know that guy is a piece of shit, you're just kind of like, oh, well, what do I do? You know, do I go back to being like that? And so it does definitely brings up a lot more questions. And so when I was in college, though, I had obviously built up some kind of confidence level and was able to still pull in some pretty decent numbers. I think my college trophy will always be having sex with this girl named Kay, and then also having sex with her roommate, Erin, having them find out about it, and then getting them to agree with threesome, which was probably the number one moment of my college fucking career. But yeah, that's my trophy from that.
That's pretty good.
Yeah. I didn't know what I was doing. I had no idea. I don't think that any of us knew what we were doing. We were all fucking 19 years old. We didn't know shit.
That's amazing, though.
Yeah.
So, And so what kind of, did you just find yourself kind of naturally progressing as you, you know,
you have to learn what girls respond to and what girls don't respond to. And, you know, I tell everybody that everyone thinks that like hitting on girls is like the fucking movie, and it's not. It's really not like that. I mean, maybe there's situations and scenarios where it plays out like that, but it really isn't like that. So everyone that I know, every guy that I've talked to, every guy that I've coached, every guy that I've met, everyone has their own game. And I think that people forget that, is that everyone has their own style of how they do things, how they hit on girls. And for me, that was where I kind of started learning what I was getting responses to, what I wasn't getting responses to. And I realized right away that the responses that I got were better when I kind of didn't approach anybody in like a hit on scenario. Like I would just start talking to girls like, hey, what's up? Like, how you doing? Want a beer? Mm-hmm. Fucking whatever. And this is where I came up with the one thing when I would go to a party or whatever. I was obviously a little bit more heavier of a drinker back then. And so I'd find a girl in the party or whatever, and I'd go to the keg, which is obviously surrounded by 50 people and you have to get in there. And so I would get in there and I'd get my two beers, and I would go to the girl that I had seen at the party and I'd give her the beer. And if she didn't want it, like I would just be like, hey, I got you a beer. My name is Drew. And that was kind of like my opener. Like, you know, that was just what I would do. I already have the drink. I'm not asking you if you want one. I'm just giving it to you. And if she didn't want it, if she was like, no, I don't want this, I would drink both of them in front of her and say, okay, cool. And then I would leave. And that was just like, became my thing. And then I would give you maybe 50% of the time that girl would find me later in the night, and I would probably hook up with her later that day.
Right.
Because it's just I like responsive. That. I don't care. Like, okay, well, I don't care. I'm trying to be cool and introduce myself. And if you don't want this fucking beer that I waited 30 minutes for, then I'm going to fucking drink it. Because guess what? I waited 30 minutes for it. So if you don't want it, I'm going to drink it. And then I would drink it right in front of them. I still do the same thing now, except I do it with shots. Because obviously I'm not buying $5 keg beers. But I'll go to a girl and be like, hey, I got you a shot. And she doesn't want it. I'll take both. I'll put it on the table and I say, okay, cool. Thanks. And then I'll just walk away. And then that's it. That's the whole end of the conversation.
I like that. And one of the things we talked about, you know, when we hung out at Warren a few weeks ago was, you know, just you expanded on that idea where you don't hit on girls, you just talk to them. And And that's, I love that because it's, you know, it's just a breath of fresh air for girls because
it's a breath of fresh air for girls, like, and it also implants the and it's subconscious. And that's something that, you know, whenever you talk to a girl, and like every single guy that talks to a girl, for the most part, in a bar is trying to hit on them. That's like the number one thing. So if you go to a girl in a bar and you're not like that, they're going to go, oh, wow, like that was refreshing. That was something that I really enjoyed. But then kind of in the back of her head, she's like, I've been hit on all night and that guy didn't hit on me.
Yeah, everyone wants what they can't have.
But yeah, that was my thing, is that whenever I speak to girls or whenever I talk to them in a social situation, it always just starts off friendly conversations. And sometimes they'll steer you into a conversation that leads you to think that they want you to hit on them. And then, but they've given you that kind of subconscious permission, you know? So then you kind of know how to react. But it takes a long time to kind of pick up on those signs, pick up on those, you know, those reactions and pick up what they mean. And again, that's learning from your mistakes, hit or miss, and then also honing in on what you get the best responses from.
And, you know, I think that can be a really effective strategy when you have a social circle or you're at a house party, or you're at a bar or a party when you have, you know, mutual friends and stuff like that.
Right.
What do you do? Cause you know, a lot of at least a big part of my progression, was going out and actually kind of like purposely hitting on girls to get over my fear of rejection.
That's an ingredient, of course. I mean, that's a way for you to break down the same barrier that I broke down. It was just your angle. It was just, let me do it this way, and then let me figure out how that works for me. So, I mean, there's nothing wrong with walking up and doing that and figuring it out, but then there's also doing it right, which is where it gets complicated. Because you can be the guy that goes up and talks to every girl. Right.
Yeah.
And hits on them. But you also don't want to be the guy that's walking around hitting on every girl in the bar. You just, there's the difference there.
Right. And it's guys really get that mixed up. You know, and they, and a lot of guys who get into pickup especially get that mixed up because they, you know, they're basically throwing all these messages, go out, hit on every girl, get rejected, approach. And trust me, I'm the first one to advocate that. Go out and do that. But then when you get to a certain level, you basically have to do the exact opposite. It's funny how it switches. Yeah. You're like, fuck, now that I don't care, I no longer care about rejection. Now I should intentionally not be hitting on girls. I was just having a conversation with Tim, who's a guy on the call, a newer member of the group. And he's like, yeah, when I do day game, like, I don't even really hit on girls. I don't even ask for their number. They just, you know, I just feel them out and usually they take mine. And that's always a sign of a guy who is, you know, no longer, he doesn't really give too much of a fuck about rejection. And they see that, you know, now it's a different game, right? Like, approaching is more of a means to an end to get over your own bullshit.
Well, it's like you don't play high school golf in PGA. You know what I mean? So your game is going to adapt. Right. Your game is going to change.
Exactly. And I love the shot line, or just go up to the girls and drink the shot in front of them. That's great.
It automatically, if the one, there's a couple of responses that you get from that. And there's either the original response, which is, okay, I still don't want the fucking shot and I still don't want to talk to you. And that's fine. That's great. There's probably 50 other girls in here that I would want to talk to you anyway. You know, you could use the line like, hey, you know, maybe I'm not the most attractive guy in this bar, but I'm the only one talking to you right now. You know, you could do something dickish like that. But, you know, that's really not the line that I advocate at all, because I'm not a fan of negging. I don't think that that's a thing. There's obviously ways to do it. Robbie knows this about me. I like to create tension with girls. I like to kind of make backhanded jokes that are dickish, but they're not mean. They're just kind of like backhanded, and then that kind of creates a repertoire. But I mean, obviously we'll keep getting into that another time. But that, for a lot of the times, it's...
But you do it in a playful way. You do it in a funny, playful
I'm always,
way.
I'm always kind of smiling and laughing when I make a dick joke. Yeah. I'm not stone-faced, sarcastic, dry. I'm laughing and I'm kind of making an offhanded joke. Sometimes that works, sometimes that doesn't. I mean, and that's something, again, that I've gotten used to at this point. So sometimes it works. But like I said, one of the responses you get could be like, oh, we'll still fuck off. The second response usually is they like kind of laugh. And then what's the number one thing that girls love to do when you're talking to a guy? Well, it's a laugh. So as soon as you create that kind of comical laughter, then you say, well, listen, the more shots of these that I do, the funnier I'm going to get. So do you want to do another one? And then maybe you get the shot for her to do one with you. But that doesn't always work. And like, again, it's not like the movies. Sometimes that line doesn't arrive. Sometimes you don't get to use it. And also it's about being quick, being witty, trying to figure out, you know, whatever you can. It's like a chess match. You have to kind of be ahead of the game at all times. Think of what her response might be, how you would react to that response. Create a conversation in your head that you think might come up. And then if it doesn't, just audible your plays, figure out what's the best move from there on out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love it. I love it. And it's any guy who's really good, they always have a decision tree in their head. It's like, all right, well, I'm going to do this. It's like, you know, it's like chess. You got to think ahead.
It's in my head. I say to myself before I even walk up, you know, if this does work out, what are the next steps? Does she drink? Does she have a drink in her hand? Is she not drinking? Is she dancing? Does she want to dance? Does she like music? You pick up on all these little signs, and that way you kind of have this path going on in your head before you go up. And that way, no matter which way the direction or, you know, the conversation steers itself into, you can kind of be prepared where it's going to go.
And that's confidence. It's knowing what to expect.
Right. And it's also repetition. The more times that you've hit on girls, a lot of the times you're going to have repeat scenarios. So if you have a repeat scenario, you kind of already have the path laid out in your head of how it's going to go. And that comes after repetition, just doing it over and over again.
Mm-hmm. So I remember one point, you were also a fat kid like me. How old were you and how did you lose the weight?
This was actually almost right before I met you. I had just kind of gotten
down. Okay, this was later.
This is recent. Again, I was an athlete. I was someone that my body was my temple. I didn't even start smoking weed until I was 24 years old. I was one of those people that just, like, I didn't want to hurt myself or anything, whatever that was. What got me fat was working as a promoter. And it's funny that I say it like that. But the thing about promoting, and especially doing it on the level that I did it, because image promoting is kind of non-existent at this point. But back, you know, in 2011, 2012, when I was doing it, 2013 even, it's a whole different level of, I guess I don't want to say power, but it's just a whole different level of access. You get all different kinds of things that you didn't have access to before. You get a lot of free dinners. You get a lot of, you get to stay later in the club even when it closes because you have a huge client or you have a celebrity or whatever that is that's hanging out with you and partying with you, and they'll stay open a little bit later. You know, anything like that. And what I was doing is I treated promoting a lot differently than a lot of the other promoters did is that I had thrown parties. I had done parties for a long time. I've worked in bars and restaurants since I was 12 years old was the first official job I got in a restaurant. But my mom was a bartender, single mom. And so I grew up in a bar. And so I was really comfortable in my place setting and where I was. And I wanted to treat promoting like a business. I didn't want to be affected by the party itself. I wasn't, you know, you can ask anybody that's met me when I'm with any of those celebs when I was in L.A. and Leonardo DiCaprio bought me a birthday champagne bottle. That's just me, like, saying to somebody that I've met, that Leo's not my friend. Right? Out of fucking clear right now. I actually have a funny story about Maddie. Last night we were at Marquee, and he was shoulder to shoulder with Leo for maybe 30 minutes before he realized that it was Leo. So me and my buddy just kind of let him stand next to him, not knowing who he was. So I'd say Maddie. Yeah, you can stand next to Leo DiCaprio for 30 minutes. But anything like that, it's I was doing it so much because I wanted to make a lot of money. So I was working 7 nights a week. I was doing 13 shifts every week and just piling in garbage into my body. It was just like, I was drinking Jameson and gingers. And because you drink so much, your tolerance is so high. So I would drink 12 of those. It's like 150 right. calories and it's all sugar. And then, you know, you get these yep. free dinners and it's, you don't get to choose what you get. They just bring out a bunch of mojo food and it's like disgusting most of the time. And it's good food, but it's fattening and you're eating it all the time. And I was just unhealthy. You know, you get done with work at 4, you're home at 5. I lived in a building that had deli in the lobby. It was 24 hours. So, you get home at 5 a.m. and they're making bacon for the next fucking morning. Yeah, you're going to stop in there and get a fucking sandwich. And then you're going to eat it. You're going to be disgusted. And then you're going to wake up in the morning after sitting on it for 8 hours. And my heaviest, I was around 215. So that came from my decision to move to LA and to take time away from nightclubs. And that was obviously a decision I made before I actually had even met you and Jesse. I moved to LA a prior occasion and just took time off. Just didn't drink and didn't do, all I did was smoke weed and read books by the pool for 2 months, maybe just read, sat by the pool, smoked, played basketball, exercised. And then before you know it, by not drinking that shitty liquor like Jameson gingers 10 times a night, the weight kind of just starts coming off. So I was definitely a chubby fat kid.
Yeah, it's amazing how much weight you can lose when you stop drinking.
Yeah, I mean, it's even, you don't have to completely stop. I mean, obviously, there's 150 calories in the Jameson and ginger, and there's 80 calories in the vodka soda. So you're talking 70 calorie difference per drink. It's obviously a little bit better. And that's what I switched to. I started drinking vodka and soda with a splash of lime juice. So that's my drink.
Yeah, that's all I ever drink. The skinny bitch. And when I bartend for you, I know how to make that one. Anything else? I don't know.
Well, we can be behind the bar.
It's not in the name.
Before we start getting into cocktails.
Well, it's funny. Just so you guys know, the, me and Jesse were in Drew's bar the other week and we're laughing at like just how much ass you get as a bartender. And Drew's like, yeah, I usually get, a number slipped to me at least a couple times a night when I'm bartending. And I had bartended one time my entire life at a Christmas party and sure enough, banged a girl that night from being a bartender.
You're a legal drug dealer. I mean, that's really what it is. Everyone likes the bartender because you're a legal drug dealer. Everyone. You're usually friendly, witty, competent
gatekeeper
of
the fun.
You also have a trade. You have a skill, and that's what everyone looks at.
Yeah. And so me and Jesse told Drew, like, we will pay you to let us bartend. We don't actually want to bartend. We just want to stand back there.
Robbie wanted to not get paid. He just wants to bartend. Jesse, however, wants to pay $20 an hour to stand at the end of the bar, and anytime anybody asks for anything, I have to look at him, and he can nod or say no. And any time that we say anything to Jesse, we have to refer to him as boss. That was it. That was all you were allowed to do. But he was willing to pay me to do this.
So good. So I will be there on Sunday making my guest bartender debut. So if anyone wants to come down to Warren 77.
I think you got Derek Glee in there. So I think if D. Lee wants to come down, we'll get him in there for to watch this. Amazing debacle, I believe, is going to happen Sunday night.
I'm sure Maddie will make his way down there, too. I see him on the call. if the name is not in the drink, I won't know how to make it. So vodka soda, vodka cranberry, Jack and Diet. I'm good. You know, Moscow Mule.
If someone asks you to make a no sidecar or something, you're done. You will know you're done. But hopefully we can get you to pour draft beer as well. That's maybe something we can hone in on.
Maybe. We'll see. But tell us, how did you get into promoting in the first place?
Chance. It was pure chance. It was, so the story of how I even got to New York is a little bit more interesting, and it kind of leads into how I got into promoting. So I was a bartender throughout college and a little bit right after I graduated high school. So bartending now.
Where did you go to college?
I went to East Stroudsburg University. I ended up leaving early. I got a full ride to play college ball. At the end of my sophomore year, I had some personal family issues and stuff. I had to drop out. So I went back home and got a job. And I was working at this Northeastern Pennsylvania. So I grew up in Philadelphia. My mom's a physical therapist. When I was 15, my mom was offered to come in on this physical therapy office, kind of like a chain, with this guy named Steve. I don't know if any of you know the boxer Vladimir Klitschko, but he's one of Vladimir's trainers, or was. I don't know if he still is. And so he kind of needed somebody who would run the offices while he was obviously doing whatever he was doing with Vladimir, and he picked my mom. So we moved to Northeastern Pennsylvania. If anyone's watched The Office, I lived about 45 minutes north of Scranton, Pennsylvania. So the boonies, literally woods all around you, nothing to see. And but in the woods, in this immense armpit of Pennsylvania, there's this resort. It's called Woodlock Resort, Woodlock Pines. And it's actually the number one all-inclusive family resort ahead of Disney. So it's a huge it's Dirty Dancing. It's a huge resort in the middle of the woods with a huge lake, and it's the perfect summertime lay because you get these girls who have been coming with their families to this fucking resort for 20 years, and now they're all 21, 22, and guess what? They leave at the end of the week. So you pick one on Monday, you got them all week, and then on Friday, they're gone, and you get a whole new rotation of those girls coming in. So that was like, it was great for me. I was bartending. I was having a great time. You know, I was home. But it gets old. It gets really old really fast because there's nothing to do in that town except for work, and you don't want to live at work. So what happened was my car broke down, and in that area of the world, you have to have a car to get around. It's part of your contract, actually, when you sign on to Woodlock, that you have to have a reliable form of transportation, and I didn't. So I was let go amicably. You know, my manager, Matt, called me and just said, hey, like, you know, when you're here, you're one of my best guys, but I just can't depend on you to be here because you don't have a car. My car was just too expensive to fix at the time. And so now I'm shit out of luck. So I go out with my buddies. We get hammer drunk. And my friend goes, you should move to New York City. He goes, you don't belong here. You grew up in a city. You don't belong in the country. Go to New York City. And I'm like, great idea. I'm broke. How the fuck am I going to go to New York City? And he goes, you'll figure it out. And that actually, I'll talk about that later on, but that became my own personal model. Fucking figure it out. So I tell him, like, listen, dude, I have, like, no money. Like, I just spent the rest of the money that I had at the bar tonight with you fucking losers. So I have no money. And he goes, well, listen, he goes, I'll give you $100 and a ride to New York City if you can find a place to stay by tonight in New York, and I'll give you a ride. So a ride and $100. So I take everything with drunk people with a grain of salt. I say, okay, cool. Fucking next morning, he's knocking on my door. Pack up. I'm taking you to New York City. You can't fucking live here anymore. He's a good friend of mine, Chris. Chris Almeida. And so he's like, you just can't live here anymore, dude. I'm taking you. No bullshit. We talked about it last night. You agreed. I'm going. You're going. Get in the fucking car. So I pack this duffel bag with just the clothes that I wore the most. I wrap up my PlayStation and I give it to him. My buddy Johnny's in the car waiting. We drive to New York. On the way to New York, I call my buddy Anthony. He's one of the two people that I know that live in New York City. He lives in Queens, and he used to work at the resort with me, and I called him, and I said, hey, remember that time you said if I ever wanted to move to New York, you'd give me a place to stay for a little bit until I got on my feet? And he was like, yeah. And I said, well, I'm in a car. I'll be there in like 2 hours. And he was just also a good friend, was like, yeah, I'll get the couch ready for you. He's like, our lease ends in a month, and we're moving to North Carolina, so you have the whole month that you can stay with us on the couch. Anthony is gay, his partner Tyler. They live together in this apartment in Queens, and I lived with them for a month. And they both worked at Bubba Gump's in Times Square. So being a bartender, Anthony said, I can probably set you up with a job. So I go in for the interview, and I think I'm going to be this Bubba Gump's fucking bartender. Stocks. Like, who fucking wants to work in Times Square at Bubba Gump's? But obviously I just needed to make money. I just needed to do anything that I could. I had $200 in cash because my buddy Johnny that came with us gave me $100 as well. So I have $200 in cash to my name, nothing else, no other money. And I have a duffel bag full of clothes and really nowhere to live. Like I'm just kind of staying with my buddy for a month. My cousin Carla at the time went to FIT, which is a gold mine of beautiful girls that love fashion in New York City. And a lot of the times they're big dum-dums. And so they can latch onto these promoters and they, whatever. So Carla and I meet for lunch because I'm new to the city. And she goes, I think you should be a promoter. And I said, what the fuck is that? So she explained to me, my cousin is Miss Pennsylvania. She's obviously a very good looking girl. And she told me that she goes out with these promoters and she gets all this free stuff. And she goes, I think you'd be good at it. You threw parties. And she's like, you're not an ugly dude. You're good with women. You're good with people. I think you should just do it. I'll give you this phone number, this guy. I call this guy. He hires me on the spot. Now, this is where it all kind of gets lucky for me. I do believe that people make their own luck, but I also believe that sometimes luck just happens, and then you have to build off of the luck that you've had. So my whole
thing
was... Wait,
but before you go into that, real quick, so when he hired you, what was that situation?
It was mind-blowing. I literally texted the guy saying, hey, I'm Carla's cousin. I heard that you were looking for promoters. And his response, his next text was, great, when can you start?
And what did that mean at the time? What was your job description? Just get girls to show up to clubs?
I had no idea. So I texted him. I said, okay, great. I can start right away. And he goes, okay, well, go to this club on Tuesday night at midnight called Double Seven and bring girls. Okay. And then that's the end of the text conversation. I don't know any fucking girls. So it's Thanksgiving break. I don't know anybody in the city except for Carla. So who do I call? Carla. Hey, Carla, you're the one that got me this job. Maybe you help me out on my first night, gather some of your friends together and come out near this club. Carla's response, I'm going to be home in Pennsylvania for Thanksgiving. So now I'm kind of like stranded. But she goes, why don't you hit up our cousin Tara, who lives in Yonkers? So I hit up my cousin Tara and I say, hey, I have this new job. I have this table at this nightclub. If you and a couple of your girlfriends want to come down to the city tonight, I have a table, everything's for free. The thing about my cousin Tara is that she's a collegiate volleyball player. So she responds and goes, actually, my entire team is back. We'll all come down. So my first night working as a promoter,
amazing.
Ever, I have this buddy that I met randomly through a friend, his name's Chapman. So I walk up to this club with Chapman, and then Tara walks up, and she's got 10 girls who are all 6 feet tall, all of them. And they're gorgeous.
Wow.
And they're huge asses, and it's great. So I'm like, this is going to be fun. And so I hit up this guy, and I say, hey, I'm outside. And he lets me inside, and he sees the girls, he sees me, and he just goes, and now, I don't know what this job is. I'm wearing a fucking tie. I don't know what this is. I don't know what's going on. I'm wearing dress pants and a button down and a tie, my haircut, everything. And
amazing.
He gives me this table in the middle of the club, and this guy Mike K. I started talking to him, and he just goes, hey, listen, I think you're gonna be good at this. I don't want you to worry about bringing out too many girls. I want you to just kind of follow me and shadow me, and I'll teach you along the way. So fast forward 3 months, and I have this, now I've built up a small core group of people, of girls. I have about 8 girls that will come out with me whenever I ask. It's a night off, and these 4 girls that I know, Yana was kind of the start. She was the star of the group. She was the girl that I was kind of flirting with, hooking up with every now and then. And then her friend Ari and the other girls who all come out. And so this is 2012, maybe? Yeah, 2012.
Wait, so I was going to ask you, so that crew of 8 girls,
right.
Were they just friends? Or it sounds like you were hooking up with one and then she'd bring out all of her friends. But that's kind of dangerous,
right,
in case it goes south with the one and you kind of lose all of your...
That's something with promoting, is not sticking your pen in company ink, is not fucking the girls that come out with you, because you fuck one girl that you bring out with you, and unless you make her your girlfriend and then you fuck somebody else, she's going to stop coming, but also 5 friends that she brings every time she comes out with you stop coming, and that's money out of your pocket. So for me, it was a business. Like I said, I didn't want to do anything like that. But in the beginning, when I was just building up a crew, that was kind of my play. It was, let me find one girl and then kind of give her the attention. She'll bring out more girls. And to this day, Yana and I are still friends, even though nothing ever really came out of it. Sometimes she'll drunk text me at 3 or 4 in the morning asking what I'm doing. So obviously I know what she wants. But, Yana and I don't really talk as much anymore, but she's still a friend and whatever. So anyway, I'm at this, they hit me up. They want to go out. It's my night off. And I said, yeah, sure. I'll get you guys to this club, SL. So we went to SL, and my buddy Caesar, who was somebody that worked in my case company as well, somebody who I'd met over the months that I'm promoting, sees me and he goes, oh my God, dude, this is great. He goes, I have a client over at this club called 10 June. If you can watch this table full of women, I have to go over and host this client. I'll pay you $200 to hang out here for the night. Dude, no doubt. All I got to do is babysit and drink liquor and hang out with my friends for sure. So I'm sitting in this club and I'm talking, and then this guy walks by me. And like I said, 2012. And so I look at this guy and I turn around and I say, I don't know if any of you guys have seen Creed or Fantastic Four or whatever. It's Michael B. Jordan. And I had just coincidentally watched Chronicle, which is one of his feature movies that he had just gotten into as a new actor. And I had just randomly watched it the night before because I was bored and I watched the movie. So I recognize him and I say, hey, is your name Mike? And he's like, yeah. And I was like, dude, this is crazy. I just watched your movie last night. I thought you were great. And he was like, hey, I appreciate that. And so I just kind of said, can I get you a drink? And he looks around at all the girls and goes, yeah, sure. I'll take a vodka cranberry. So now he's talking to Ari, who is one of Yana's friends. And as luck has it, Mike comes up to me and goes, hey, if you want, we're having an after party across the street. We just wrapped this movie. If you want to bring these girls over, you can come over with me. I said, yeah, for sure. So I grab them. We walk over to this party, and it's the wrap party for a movie called That Awkward Moment, which starred Michael B. Jordan, Zac Efron, and Miles Teller. So I meet Zac Efron at this party, and we just hit it off as buddies. It just random. Just started talking with him, and he kind of just took a liking to me, and then we kind of just started fucking around with these girls at this party, and then we just became buddies. He took my phone number down, said, listen, and, you know, the movie wrapped, him to be in New York for a few weeks. Why don't we hang out? So now I've had a huge stroke of luck. I have a major A-list celebrity who wants to come out with me specifically, and I'm going to take him out. So Sunday night, I walk into One Oak with Zac Efron, and I remember everyone around me is just like, who the fuck is this kid? Like, he started 6 minutes ago, and all of a sudden he's bringing out A-list. I'm like, what the fuck? And it was all stroke of luck. But because it kind of propelled me up a few levels that I didn't have before, I built off of that platform and just kind of acted like I belonged there. Like, oh, no, yeah, no, me and Zach are friends. You know, Zach and I are not friends anymore. I haven't heard from him ever since he went to rehab, and I might have something to do with why he went. But in general, it was just kind of a stroke of luck that I built a platform off of. And that introduced me to other celebs, other athletes, stuff like that. And that's kind of how I made a name for myself pretty quickly and was able to carry it on for about five and a half, 6 years that I promoted in New York.
Well, I love that because it's just another story of a guy takes a risk and does something a little bit scary and a little bit crazy, and it pays off.
Oh, yeah. And again, it was also, you know, the confidence of, I just walked right up to Zach and just was like, hey, man, what's up? And he was just like, hey. And this conversation went, he goes, who are you? I said, I work over at SL. I met Michael. And he goes, oh. He goes, well, listen, this never happened. And I said, me being at this party or you being at this party? And he kind of looked at me and he goes, me being at this party. And I was like, you're in movies or something, right? And he's like, I'm going to get along. So like, that was kind of how that started. And it was just because I was a little bit drunk, just walked up to this fucking hugely famous person and was just like, hey, like, what's up?
Right. And you knew it was Zach beforehand, right?
Oh, of course. I mean, okay. I mean, yeah. He had a, kind of like a stubble and he was wearing a beanie at the time, but like, I mean, I knew who he was.
Right. I love that approach.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I was just like, hey, what's up?
You're in movies or something, right?
Yeah. He was just like, this didn't happen. And I was like, me being here or you being here? And he just said, me being here. Well, whatever. I don't really know you. I was like, to be honest, I've never seen High School Musical. So I don't know really what you've been into. But that's kind of what I got. And I said that to him at one point. But it was just kind of like, you know, at that point, we had joked around a little bit. So it's funny.
Right. Oh, I love that. Just yeah. Same approach that you would, you know, not giving a fuck. Same with chicks, celebrities.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's something about standing next to Zach that allows a lot of girls to come up and start talking to you. So that was another thing right. that I used to build up my promotion group. And that was where my difference started. Because Yana and those girls weren't models. They were just hot girls. They were just hot girls that went to FIT and Pace. Now, standing next to Zach, I'm surrounded by 5'9", 5'10", model girls. You know what I mean? Super skinny. They have campaigns. They actually go to work. And back then, it wasn't like it. Model apartments weren't really a thing yet. Maybe Ellington Keys had model apartments, and maybe a couple other guys, Isaiah, maybe. Like, you know, it was maybe there was four model apartments at the time that were ran by promoters. Most of the model apartments were still run by the actual agencies themselves. So at the time, you could only get in if you were like a working model. Like, you had to actually be signed. You had to be on an agency. You had to be going to castings, being on a campaign, whatever that was. And this was kind of my access into that world, was hanging out with Zach and being around some of those girls.
Yeah, and so tell us about that. When how did your promoting career change course? How come you never got into the, you know, running a moho, and how'd you end up in LA?
Oh, I did. I ran two mohos, actually.
Oh, you did? Okay. So
basically what had happened with Mike, the original guy that had hired me, was that I had started bringing, so there's this club called Pink Elephant, and I used to work it on Friday nights on 8th Street. And the scenario there was I wasn't at the level yet that I was getting flat rate, which is just they pay you a flat rate every time you come in. It doesn't matter, but they were paying me per head. They were paying me for how many girls I would bring. I had this partner named Mike, and Mike and I were bringing 82 girls a night. They had to give us 5 tables in Pink Elephant because we would just bring, he went to Syracuse and then transferred to Columbia. So he had all the Columbia girls and all the girls that came in from Syracuse to the city. I had all the girls that I was building up with, you know, whatever. And so by the time that I had met Zach, I had a ton of girls that wanted to come. Not by the time that I met Zach, but like at some level after I had hung out with Zach, it was like I had a ton of girls that were coming out with me. But yeah. Because I was more focused on the whole modeling thing, Mike and I approached this guy named Tarek. And Tarek was a model image promoter. He was well known. He had been huge in the game since around 2008. He was more than willing to jump on with us, and we created a partnership with him. He had one of his own mohos. He kind of gave us some funding for our own moho. But the deal was he would get the apartment. We just had to pay the rent on it. So he would pay us, and then we had to pay the rent. And that's the thing about promoting too, is that when you get into that scenario where all of a sudden, like for me at Labo Thursdays, I was making $1,200 a night. I mean, you rack up a lot of money, but you're spending so much money. You're spending transportation for the girls. You're buying dinner for the girls. You're tipping out every dinner you go to. You're obviously paying the $2,500 in rent each month for some shitty Hell's Kitchen apartment. It's, you know, you make a lot, but you spend a lot. So your take home is basically dirt. Right. But that was the thing too. So I jumped into the whole image thing after meeting Zach. And then, you know, because of Zach, I had met probably I would say 8 to 10 models that were kind of like my friends, like girls that would come out with me, not all the time, but girls like who wanted to go out would hit me up. So by using that core group, and then also the hundreds of girls that Mike and I had accumulated through like his network and all, you know, whatever, those are more like the Giannis, the more hot girls that went to Pace and NYU and Columbia and shit like that. Not really the model type. So we dove into this image promoting thing, and the money was great. And we just kind of, I don't know. Mike's a very attractive dude. Obviously hard to be next to a guy who's better looking than you, because he's going to gather most of the attention, especially in that scenario and that scene. But, he was such a good dude. He was kind of religious, so he wasn't really like a kind of one night stand hookup dude. So which is great for me, because he, you know, I'm next in line. I'm standing next to Mike, and if Mike's like, no, like, sorry, I love God, then I get the second pickup. So it worked out nicely. And I ran two mohos for a while, and then by the time that I had gotten sick of doing promoting, I closed down.
Yeah. So what led you to kind of leave the business or whatever, and then how did you end up in LA?
So one of the, where do I start with this? So basically I told you before that I'd gotten kind of chubby and I'd gotten fat by being a promoter, you know, just by, you know, I was fucking, I'm product of my environment. So if every night I'm going out with 15 models, the girls that I'm probably going to have sex with and date are going to be models. Not that I had anything other than that. It wasn't like I had a specific game at the time. It wasn't like I was special by any means. It was just, you're a product of your environment. You're getting paid all this money to bring up these 15 girls, and they're all models. You're going to end up fucking one of them, and you're going to end up dating one of them, whatever the fuck that means. So after a while, and I had gotten chubby and whatever that was, I had just kind of gotten to a point where, again, I wasn't really affected by the party, and I was just getting kind of tired of it. It's the same people. Listen, it's 2017. I started promoting in the end of 2010, and nothing ever changes. You see the same people, it's the same crowd, it's the same everything. And I just got really fucking tired of it. I was unhealthy, I wasn't feeling good about myself. And so one of the, I guess, celebrities that I had met, he's a little bit lower on the totem pole, his name's Josh Lawson. He's been in a couple of Will Ferrell movies. He was in The Campaign. He was in Anchorman 2. I don't know if anybody's seen Anchorman 2, but he's the Australian guy that owns the network that they end up working for. But he was a good friend. He was someone that obviously, like, being older on the totem pole, he can come out with me and he wasn't going to get bombarded. And he loved going out with us because obviously there's girls around all the time. And he came in for the Tribeca Film Festival and just kind of was blunt with me. He's like, dude, you look like shit. He's like, you look awful. He's like, you look tired. You look fat. You look just unhealthy in general. And I kind of told him, like, you know, I was tired of not, like, take home stock. I wasn't making a ton of money, but I was exerting all of this shit into making enough money so I could spend half of it on the fucking business that I was in. So it was just frustrating. It was annoying. And he goes, I think you should move to Los Angeles. He goes, I think it would be a nice break for you. You can get away from the city. You've been here a long time now. He's like, I think maybe it's time that you kind of just change your scene, whatever. I wasn't sold on it. I never really ever kind of wanted to live in LA. It was never appealing to me. The weather maybe, but not really the city itself. But I kind of, you know, I had a couple of drinks with Josh and, you know, he's talking to me. And then finally he goes, what if I pay for your plane ticket? And I said, really? And he goes, if I pay for your plane ticket and you can live with me for a month or so, would you do it? And I was like, yeah, I'd probably do it then. Next morning I wake up and I have a confirmation email that he had purchased me a ticket to Los Angeles. So the first time I moved to LA was just a good friend kind of looking out for me and getting me out of the scene that I was obviously unhappy in. And so I moved to Los Angeles the first time. I stayed with Josh for a couple of weeks. Robbie, you've met my best friend, Jared, who grew up, born and raised in Manhattan. He lives in LA now. And I moved in with him after living with Josh. And Jared is a, you know, the weed dispensary. And so I kind of just hung out with him. Like I said, smoked and hung out by the pool and read books for a little bit. While I'm in LA, I get this phone call from this guy in New York who I'd met and then I've seen. And he wants to open up a nightclub, kind of coffee shop, speakeasy nightclub in the back. And he wants my help. So he hires me for a 6-month consulting job and I have to come back to New York for six months. So I come back to New York for 6 months and this is where I meet Jeff. And so, when I met Jesse while I was here in New York, it was something that I had actually known Kira, prior, you know, based off of the industry. And Kira and I wouldn't say we're like friends, but we were very friendly. We knew each other. It was like, hey, how are you? How have you been? Like quick conversations, 5-minute snippets of just, hey, what's up? And then so maybe like a couple of like weeks before I was supposed to go back to LA after my 6-month contract is up. I was, dating Jordan. It was very fresh. It was very new. We had met like Jordan and I had met 2 weeks before I left for LA. So this is obviously, I meet Jesse a week before I go to LA. This is me and Jordan are still very new. But we go to this party at 48 Ace and, I run into Kira, who, like I said, I knew of, you know, we just knew each other. She introduced me to Jesse and the rest, I guess, is, you know, that's kind of where you pick up into the story. So, but yeah, that was kind of my process of moving to LA. It was just getting out of the nightclub scene, the nightlife scene. And then obviously coming back to the 6-month consultation, I was opening a nightclub. So I'm talking to a lot of people that are still in that nightclub scene and I'm going out again. What that did was it helped me stay relevant because I was away for 4 months and in that industry, you can be forgotten very fast. And, by the time that I had gotten back and kind of popped my head in, it was a short enough period of time that when people saw me, they were like, oh, hey, like, what's up, man? Like, how have you been? How's LA? Like, oh my God, you lost so much weight. You know what I mean? Like shit like that. And so it was kind of like a way for me to stay relevant and save space in that industry. And it's something I still do. I still like to pop out to a nightclub maybe once every 2 weeks and just make a round, you know, go to Avenue, go to Oak, go to Tao, PhD, whatever, and just pop in and say hello to some people and kind of just make sure that my face gets remembered. That way, if I ever, you know, do anything else, that, you know, these people know who I am.
Yeah, well, last time I popped into Oak with you, they gave us a table and bottle, and here you go.
But my server that was with me that night, Katie, still talks about that night, how she didn't realize that I could walk in with 4 dudes, 3 girls, and they're just going to give me a table full of liquor without even having to ask me. It's like, yeah, that's kind of the perks of the job, I guess, after a long time of doing it and knowing everybody when you walk in and just say, hey, can you throw me a table for me and my friends? Oh, yeah, for sure. Here you go.
There you go.
Yeah. Obviously, having girls helped. I went to One Oak in a similar fashion with Chris Stone and Jason, and I think it was Maddie as well. I think Maddie was with us. And we ended up buying a table and just splitting it. It was like, I don't know, like $400 each. It wasn't that big a deal. They gave me obviously a huge discount, but they were just like, you don't have any girls with you. Like, normally if you have girls with you, I don't give a fuck. But because it's just you four dicks, like, I have to do something. So he charges $1,000 for a table, and we just split it like four or five ways.
That story makes me think of the quote, how the mighty have fallen. You're hanging out with all these girls in Zac Efron. Now you're hanging out with dorks and leverage.
How the mighty have fallen. How the mighty have fallen.
Well, I mean, listen, don't exclude me from that dork.
You enhance my social circle more than you think. I'm happy with the Eskimo family that we've created at this point. Obviously, the perks have come from Robbie's connections as well. So I feel like I've done all right. Maybe I've fallen down a peg, but I feel like I've done okay.
That's fucking hilarious. Yeah. Tell us how you ended up at, you know, how'd you get the job at Warren? Because it seems like you're really happy there. Turn that place around.
I mean, for everyone to know, I'm 26 years old. So this all happened in just this past 5 years. This is not a story that I'm telling from, you know, a long way away or whatever it was. And again, treating promoting like a business and kind of learning the ins and outs of how nightclubs run, how nightclubs work, and stuff like that. It's something that I've always been interested in. But being as young as I am, there wasn't really anybody that was going to give me the shot at being a manager or being a GM, just because even though you've got 4 or 5 years of experience as a promoter, you don't have any experience of being a manager. You don't have any experience of being a GM. So even though you kind of know the inner workings, it's not really enough at that age to kind of give you that position. So I was struggling. I just really wanted a position in an industry that I knew, that I was good at. So the job kind of came about. I was back. So I moved back to LA after I meet Jesse, and I moved back in with Jared because that was kind of obviously the whole plan all the time. Jesse found out that I was kind of, I shouldn't say living in squalor, but I just wasn't living in a situation that I really wanted to be living in. And so Jesse generously offered to let me stay at his house. I didn't have to pay rent, but in return, I had to be his bitch. I had to do whatever he wanted me to do. Errands, clean shit up, you know, do check-ins, anything that he needed. And I was more than willing to do that. I was, you know, Jesse likes to call me his Drew just because I was able to kind of fix a lot of shit around the house and do stuff that he didn't want to deal with. So that was me being back in Los Angeles and kind of learning about how Jesse and Robbie do things, about, you know, obviously being around them. You pick up things that you realize that you're doing, and they're just doing them better. And so you're just like, I got to follow what, you know, whatever this is. And Robbie and I have had conversations. I remember Coachella weekend one last year. Robbie and I argued for like maybe 30 minutes about how we disagreed on a certain point about women in relationships. But at the same time, you learn from guys who are obviously doing it better than you are. I mean, there's obviously always models around. When I party with them in LA, there was always girls around. People with high social circles and you know, high on the social hierarchy or anything like that was great for me. So by the time that I the end of mine and Jordan's relationship was basically I flown back to New York. I think Robbie described in the introduction on Facebook that some crazy shit went down with me and her, and we ended our relationship. And so I just kind of went back to working for Jesse, but Jesse and Robbie are now in New York. They have switched over from LA and they're going to do their time here in New York. So I'm just working in New York. The guy that I had opened the nightclub with, his name is Eddie Bilovich. He was the door guy at One Oak in New York City for a few years. He's like fucking nightlife legend. It's somebody that I'm very grateful was that took a liking to me and was a friend, because if anyone's ever met him or anyone knows Eddie, he is silent. He doesn't talk to anybody. He's one of those people that he's like, listen to many, speak to few. So he's just one of those guys that's very quiet, very calculated. And I'm sitting at home one day and he calls me. He goes, I heard you're back in New York. And I said, yeah, well, you know, temporarily, I'm still planning on going back to LA. And he goes, well, listen, I have this sports bar. I need a GM. You were an athlete. You know how to run a bar. The job's yours. Yes or no? And I said, fuck, Eddie, yeah, for sure. I mean, this is a position I've been looking for in this industry for a long time. And so when I took over the bar, the bar's been open for about 8 years. And it had gotten to a point where it just bars turn over a lot. And so a bar that's 8 years old obviously has seen a lot of different trends. It's seen a lot of different people come through, different ideas, things like that. And at the time, it had hit kind of a dead period. Tribeca, if anyone's been around here, knows that it's very neighborhoody. It's very, like, everyone kind of knows everybody. So it was a very neighborhood bar. It was a very regular bar. And we just wanted to be able to take what I had learned, you know, in promoting and getting people in the door and stuff like that, and getting the right people in the door, maybe a younger crowd, a better looking crowd, more girls, and doing stuff like that. And so I kind of just took all these ideas that I had had in the years that I had been hoping for this job, and then put them into action. And in my first 6 months, I've hit 76% sales growth. So we actually have moved forward, and we're going to open a second location in Meatpacking. And if I play my cards right, I will be a percentage owner of that and director of operations. So it's a big deal for me. It's something that I've looked forward to for a long time. And it's just, I tell this to people, you know, the relationship wise, like when I ended it with Jordan and I was single, it really allowed me to focus on work. And I think maybe that's kind of what propelled me a little bit faster, was that I had that ability to kind of separate my relationships and girls for a little bit and just kind of focus on work. But then what I realized is that by being a bartender and a GM, you're going to get girls in the bar. So it definitely worked itself out where I still was getting girls in the bar. And it wasn't affecting how I went to work or anything like that.
Yeah. And that's a huge thing. If you can find a job that, or if you can find something that pays you to also have the benefit of being around lots of hot girls, then you're,
And the great thing about the neighborhood, the great thing about the neighborhood is the hot girls that come in here all work for JP, you know, Chase Bank, and they work for Goldman Sachs. And so, you know, they don't need no man with no American Express. They have their own. And that's something that Rodney will explain that I've done, is I don't buy shit for girls. I don't pay for vacations. I don't, half the time, I won't even buy your drinks. It started before when I was broke and I had no money.
You were getting paid for by Jordan. Girls were paying your way.
Yeah. I mean, Jordan paid for hotel rooms. Jordan, obviously we know how, but Jordan was paying for hotel rooms. She bought Coachella tickets. She paid for plane tickets. She paid for everything. And she was smoking hot, and she's not the first, and she definitely won't be the last. But I have this girl, Allie, who I've been hanging out with, that Jesse met. I think Robbie, you might have met as well. I know John Cole met Allie when I took her to the bar. She's cool. She's, you know, she's not like model. I call her a noddle. Noddles are girls who could be models. They're, you know, they're like tall and pretty and stuff like that, but they're just not like the whole model material. So I call them noddles. So Allie's a noddle for sure, but she's super cool and whatever, but she like refuses to buy, like she refuses to let me buy my own drinks when we're out at bars. She always wants to pay. She like let me sleep at her house for like 4 days and she was gone. Like she just lets me do shit. It's I don't know. It's weird. But it's part of who I am. I guess it's part of my game, and that's something that I've honed in on trying to be good at. So,
yeah. Well, you'll have trouble with that pretty soon once they find out you're a percentage owner of a successful bar. But,
Well, I mean, and the good thing now is Jesse was quick to throw me into the "you don't make as much money as you think you do" conversation. But and he's right. I mean, I definitely don't make a ton of money. I definitely make more money than I did. You know, my take home. It's somewhere maybe around 80 to 85 a year. Cause right now I don't really have a ton of expenses. I live close to work, so I can kind of walk and travel easily without paying a lot of money. My phone bill is not expensive, and other things like that. So it's, my take home is pretty good right now, but I'm looking at a new apartment and stuff like that. So I'm sure it'll go down, but I don't really talk about
New York is
in general.
Well, New York is very tough to afford unless you, if you want an active social life in New York, you're going to spend $150,000 a year. But if you work at a bar and that's your social life and you get hooked up every time you go out, those expenses are zero.
November 16th, 2018 will be, it'll be 7 years that I've almost had to pay for alcohol liquor in New York City. Because obviously in promoting, all the liquor you get is free. And then here at the bar, obviously I can drink for free. And when I was broke living with friends, they always kind of took care of me. So that's kind of my scenario, is that I've been going on a long time now without having to pay any money. But now that I make the money, I'm one of those people that I do like to cover the tabs. I do like to, you know, cover the drinks. When you guys were in the bar last week, Jesse was really generous and gracious about telling me, like, thanks. But it's something that I do for you guys because you guys have done so much for me. If people don't know, Robbie and I didn't know each other at all when Jesse offered for me to live in their house. So the fact that even Robbie was more than willing to kind of let this new kid come in and live with them and whatever, I was super grateful. And so for me now that I make any sort of money or any kind of like that, I do kind of like to repay my favors in any way possible. You know, so that was something I did.
Yeah. No, it was awesome, man. I'm sure my bar tab would have been probably around $150 that night. So.
Yeah, it was pretty high, but it's, you know, that's the perks of being in control of the bar, is that I can do that. I can take care of it and get my manager discount and take care of it myself. So.
Right. Well, let's I love the story. I love how you basically like just made a bunch of something from nothing. About all that. It's very inspiring. You know, it just goes to show, like, guys think they need to have all their ducks in a row, or they need this ready before they can do that. But it's really just all about relationships. If you're good with relationships, or you can learn to be good with relationships, and you can leverage those relationships, you can do whatever the fuck you want. And doesn't matter if you have money or not. And eventually those relationships will lead to money.
So you know what I used to say when I was in promoting is that it wasn't about what you make, it's about the hands you shake. And so that was something I said all the time. Networking in that scene is unbelievable, because that's where a lot of the promoters that you see now, they're like, oh yeah, my friend. These dudes aren't your friends. These millionaire, billionaire dudes, they're not your friends. But they will use you and they will give you the advantages that you do need.
Yeah. And hot girls are a commodity. If you can control hot girls, you can sway the decisions of people with money, and there you go. And I don't say that like they're a commodity, we should look at them less, but you know, guys will pay. You know, it's goes to show. Oh, the one other question I wanted to bring up, what have you noticed, like, the mistakes that most dudes, you know, most of the clients you have in the nightlife industry, guys who buy bottles, you know, are there any like just obvious mistakes? I know there's the obvious ones, but is there anything maybe less obvious or anything noteworthy about, you know, what most of those guys do?
Oh yeah, no, I was just saying that by wearing a suit, like when I got the nickname Gatsby, I made everyone that worked for me wear suits. It was kind of a joke in the beginning. And then afterwards it wasn't a joke because we looked important. And it was all falsehood. It was obviously we weren't important. We were just promoters wearing suits. But it allowed for some certain guys to come up to us and start talking to us because they thought maybe we were more than we were. But that connection also allows you to just be like, no, man, like, I'm just a promoter. If you want to hang out with us, buy a bottle. And so then, you know, all of a sudden these guys are like, well, shit, let's hang out with these guys who are dressed well, surrounded by all these girls and models and whatever. And then obviously they want to talk to you about, you know, what else you got. You know, they introduce you to other people that have more money, other people that might be in your focus. You know what I mean? So it's definitely a good tool. Just to shake every hand you can, introduce yourself. And that's what a lot of guys forget too. When they go out to bars and stuff, they're all focused on just talking to the girls. But sometimes you'll meet a dude who maybe he brings you out next time and he's got 10 girls with him. You know what I mean? You don't even have to care about it next time, because that was me. I always just kind of like to talk to everybody at the party. I always have a good time. As Robbie said, I'm never one of those people that sulks in the corner, whatever. I just like to bounce around, say what's up to people, kind of keep to myself, but also shake hands and say what's up. And that's an energy that I think attracts certain people. So.
Yeah. Well, dope. Let's I'm going to unmute everyone and open it up to questions. So anyone who has a question for Drew, fire away.
Fire away.
And there's going to be an awkward pause because no one's going to ask a question for a little while. But we're just going to sit here and sit in the tension until someone does.
Sit in the awkward silence. It's actually a specialty of mine.
Mm-hmm.
Sitting in awkward silence.
I love making it awkward because then they always ask questions, but we have to.
The Rangers just scored, so happiness.
None of you fuckers have a question? Are you kidding me? I know Maddie's got a question.
I'm not very interesting. What can I say?
Yeah, boring. That story was not interesting at all in the slightest. Well, maybe you answered everyone's question. Well, let me ask you the question that I think maybe I broke up. What are the common mistakes that you see guys making in clubs? You know, guys buying bottles.
So, yeah, well, that's the first mistake. Don't be that guy. No one buys tables in my clubs anymore unless you're just, you either are a billionaire and make too much money or you're like just seeking attention. That's mistake number one is don't be that guy. Mistake number two is the thing with nightclubs is obviously because they're so loud, to be able to talk to anybody, you have to be really up in their personal space. And some guys don't know how to maneuver personal space. They don't know how to talk sometimes about like spitting in the girl's face because they're trying to be loud. They don't know how to not yell in a girl's ear because that's fucking painful and that sucks. I see mistakes a lot where it comes where guys are invading a personal space without knowing how to maneuver around it. Body language, you know, for me, if I'm talking to a girl in a nightclub, I'm standing the same direction she's standing and I'm leaning over my shoulder to talk to her in her ear quietly because she can hear me. I'm right in her ear. So she can hear me. I talk quietly or just in a normal voice. I don't yell. And I see a lot of people that do that where they stand too close when they're talking. And then obviously that creates, she's already picking apart things. It's just like, oh, maybe your breath smells and you spit when you talk. Maybe you're yelling too loud in the club. Maybe you're drunk. Maybe you're sweating, you know, anything like that. So I see a lot of that. I see a lot of just not knowing. Yeah.
Yeah. Fuck. Whenever someone like, if you're talking really close, you have to yell. You're going to spit in someone's face.
Right. Like, and that's the thing is that you're not talking to her face. Talk to her ear and talk in a normal voice because that's how she's going to hear you. That's how she's going to be able to answer the question. Another thing is obviously there's little things, there's little details. And I'm obviously a detail focused person. That's kind of how I've always been. I like to create, like, you know, we talked about having that tree of the conversation of knowing where it's going to go and knowing how it's going to end. And that's something that I do in a lot of situations where I kind of just put the scenario in my brain. If something happens, I know how to fix it because I've already thought about it. So there's other things that I've learned. Don't ever hold your drink with two hands. It makes you look shy and it's also closing you off. If you holding your arms in front of you, you're not open. You're just holding you're blocking yourself off from anybody wanting to talk to you. And it looks awkward. Why are you holding your drink with two hands? You're not, it's not a sippy cup. The other thing is always kind of hold your drink in your left hand, even if you're not right. Even if you're not left-handed, it's a thing where I've noticed that, there's condensation on glasses, obviously, or maybe you spill it a little bit, it runs over the side and you immediately shake a girl's hand. And now instead of it being liquor, it's, you have clammy hands. You have sweaty, clammy hands and that's, no one likes to shake hands with someone like that. So there's little things like that I notice that people do, and it's just something that I do, so obviously I notice it, but maybe a lot of guys don't notice it because it's not something that they do.
Well, yeah, it's subtle, but it makes such a huge difference. Like,
you
only have one chance to make a first impression, and if your first impression is clammy hands, wet hands, spitting in her face,
and
yelling
spitting in her face, yeah.
Good luck.
That's not really the great start. That's not really the start you're looking for.
You're fucking done. That's it.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, there's different approaches to different scenarios, like a house party compared to a bar compared to a nightclub. There's always different ways to approach and always different ways to do things. And there's obviously mistakes that are made in every scenario that sometimes are out of your control, but are sometimes just very much in your control. They're very much things that you can change that are going to affect, you know, the positive response that you're going to
get. So where do you see kind of the nightclub industry going? I mean, what I've seen, obviously, is a huge shift to festivals, warehouse parties.
The promoter scene is basically right before I moved to LA for the first time, I had a budget meeting with Tao Group, and they had dropped our promoter budget, and they had also explained to me that back then, this is 2016, so bottle sales were down 30-40%. Now they're down almost 50%. Vandal, which is a club that reopened in the old Finale space on Bowery, did $27 million their first year, and then their second year dropped 62%. It's a struggle because here's the thing. When I was starting promotions, like I said, you had to be a model or you had to know somebody to get into these nightclubs or you had to spend the money. Back then it wasn't bad to spend the money because you had to. obviously guys like Jesse who figured out the hack. Like, you just make friends with the promoter, maybe buy a bottle for like a day or two, and then you don't ever have to do it again, and you just get to hang out. The scenario that I saw was that promoting ruined nightclubs, honestly. Basically what it was is that, like, for me, I was getting paid $1,200 a night at Lavo. That's 3 hours of just sitting with models and drinking liquor, and they paid me $1,200 for it. It's ridiculous. It's ridiculous money, and it's not something that anybody who's 23 years old should make. But anybody who thinks that they're a businessman at any sort at that young of an age and they're trying to be some kind of entrepreneur, like most of us were, what we did was you hire something called a sub promoter. So for me, I would find, some NYU college kid who's 19 years old with a fake ID and be like, hey man, you bring 10 tall hot girls from NYU, I'll pay you $200 to go to Lavo and hang out. That's a dream come true for them. They have no idea that I'm making $1,000 on top of what I'm paying them. But the fact is, right, I don't even have to show up. I don't even have to go to the club. I can open up another contract on the same night, the same price, do the same thing again. And the problem that started is that not only was I doing it, but everybody was doing it. So then all of a sudden, the whole promoting industry is just sub-promoters. You're not even talking to the guys that the tickets names are on. Like, you know, for me, it was, obviously, it's like Lior, who used to work for me. He would walk in and he'd be like, hey, I'm Lior. I work for Drew. And someone would come up to him, and a manager or anybody, and be like, who are you? Like, I've never met you before. Where's Drew? Because they expect you to be there. But after a while, it just got tiring to kind of keep up with who subs were who. And so subs kind of took over the game. But then subs started hiring their own subs. And then it became, people leaning on their power and stuff like that to get whoever they could into the club. And you have to remember in 2011, 2012, whatever, they used to just kind of be like the cool kids. The cool kids were allowed in clubs, the models and the promoters and whatever. And now they were kind of letting anybody in. They were kind of letting anybody in that was decently hot or would spend $1,000 on a bottle to add onto a promo table. I mean, it was all bullshit. That's why they raised promo minimum commissions. It used to be anything you sold, you got 10%. Now you have to sell more than $5,000 a night to get any kind of commission, because they were realizing that these promoters like me were just bringing in these guys for like $500 and just being like, hey, like, I can bring you in. So the whole thing is like, promoters, sub promoters, they just convoluted everything. Like, they just took over everything and no one knew who was anybody, and they started letting everybody in. And all the cool kids were like, what the fuck is this? You're ruining our party. Yeah. This is supposed to be for us. This is not supposed to be for them. And I know that it sounds offensive, but it really was kind of the kings and the peasants. It was like, why are you letting these fucking dirty peasants in here? These fucking bridge and tunnel, Jersey Shore, Guido, fucking fake tan girls in this bitch, when I would much rather the pasty 6-foot girl who signed to Wilhelmina. Like, why are you doing this? Like, why are you ruining all this party for us? And that just spread throughout all these nightclubs, all this industry. And so what happened is the cool kids started moving to bars. They started moving to dive bars. They started moving to places like the Garrett. Bounce even is more of a club, but it also had more of a bar feel to it. So people were going to places like that. And I think that's where the trend will be for the next 5 to 10 years, is going to be bars. You're going to see more bars opening. And you saw a little bit is that people tried the idea of doing like lounges and speakeasies for like the cool kid. You know what I mean? Like, oh, we'll do a club, but it'll be called a lounge. Or, we'll do a bar, but we'll make it a speakeasy. And that just, that worked for a little bit. People didn't really buy into that idea. And now that's why I kind of was excited to take over like a divey bar, because this is where people want to go now. They want to feel like they still have that connection with everyone, where they know everybody in the bar and they know all the connections they have. But also, it's a place where they can kind of just be themselves and hang out and drink and not have anyone judge them, which is what clubs used to be. And now it's not like that anymore. So I think for the next five, the thing is that nightclubs will never die. You have the industry in Vegas, you have the industry in Singapore. The place
where I've lived through this full circle now. When I first started going out, it was all bars. Clubs were gross.
Right, right.
No one went to clubs except your like ghetto people, bridge and tunnel fuck.
They were tacky. They were tacky. Yeah.
And then they, around 2005, 2006, they started like, it became cool again. And then they just kind
of became exclusive. And that was the big deal, is that it became exclusive. It became, you had to know somebody to get in, or you had to be super attractive. Rule number one, be attractive. Rule number two, don't be unattractive. That's, that was kind of the nightlife motto. and that changed. That kind of ruined the entire thing for a lot of people. I mean, look at you guys, look at Jesse. I don't think Jesse went to a nightclub more than once when I lived with him in LA, and it was just because that's not the scene anymore. It's not fun. It's not what it used to be, and it's just not cool. So people want to be part of things that are cool and trendy, and that's not what's cool and trendy. So.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, in 2011, 2012, 2013, the first kind of live-in we did for IC, you know, we went to a club almost every night, and it was great. But that, you know, that quickly, it was, I remember right when Sherbond, who's on the call, right when Sherbond joined, that was kind of when we started to see a decline in clubs. But prior to that, I mean, clubs were the bomb. Like, it was so easy. Go to a club, get a bottle, and just, like, pick them up at a bar, and they come over, and, you know. But,
and that's it. And that's it.
Yeah,
it was very simple.
Give it 10 years. The clubs will be back.
Of course, and like I said, the industry will never die. Nightclubs will never die. I mean, obviously some will close, but some of the bigger ones, obviously like Lavo and Marquee, the ones that make a lot of money, especially in Vegas. I mean, you'll never see Hakkasan or XS or anything go down because Vegas is and same as New York. New York has obviously Avenue right now. Avenue was opened in 2009, and now they're closing for the summer to do an overhaul renovation and make a whole new club. But because they have the Avenue name, you know, a club like that will never go away. One Oak won't go away. I mean, maybe Up and Down would go away at some point, but I know they're opening up a new Up and Down in LA. Obviously, Tau Group just opened up 4 new clubs in Los Angeles. They opened up Beauty and Essence, Tau, Avenue, and PhD. So yeah, I mean, the industry will never die, but it definitely will be put on the back burner for a little bit.
Well, awesome. Thanks so much for coming on, Drew. I'll let you get back to the game. Sounds like you got someone waiting for you there.
Yeah, singers.
And so if anyone has questions, I'm going to throw this podcast up under your intro. And I'm stoked that you're in the group now. And thanks for coming on the call. Awesome.
Hey,
awesome
thanks
interview.
For having me. I really appreciate it. Thanks.
Yeah, man. I'll hit you up later.
All right, guys. All right. Thank you.
All right. See you guys.
Thanks for listening. If you want more, go to innerconfidence.com and don't forget to subscribe to this podcast for the latest episodes.